Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k. Welcome, everyone, to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast, where each week we bring you education and information that will help you take your next step in building wealth real estate. I am your host, Lauren Wells, and I am joined here today by Josh Cantwell. Great to have you, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Josh, I'm really excited about this episode. Josh has literally probably invested and done every aspect of real estate. He manages over $40 million in private money, which is currently deployed into multifamily real estate and apartments. But he has been involved in wholesaling, rehabbing, rentals, foreclosure, apartment transactions, and everything in between, and currently manages over 3,000 cash-flowing apartments. He is a CEO and founder of a variety of successful businesses, including Freeland Ventures and Strategic Real Estate, is a strategic real estate coach. So great to have you here, Josh. Thank you for joining me today. I'm really excited to speak with you and really dive into your real estate journey and kind of advice you would have for people just getting started today.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for the intro. I guess, Lauren, I think the first thing to kind of start with is reverse engineer the journey a little bit. We're focused exclusively on large multifamily projects. We typically buy multifamily properties between 100 doors to 400 doors. The largest deal I've ever done was 730 doors. I currently own one that's 586 doors. I own another that's 492 doors. And the smallest one I've ever done is 5 doors. So we've done them everywhere in between.
Quite a range.
Yeah. One of my favorite deals we've ever did, actually, was a little 54 unit that we bought about a year and a half ago. It was actually a part of, it wasn't a senior assisted living community, but there was a senior assisted living community next door. And the developer owner of that decided to build a brand new senior assisted living facility. And he decided to sell off what was essentially market rate apartments or 54 units. He decided to sell that off separately because it was retail, but it was generally a much older crowd of residents. And then there was a separate building that was about 100 units of assisted living. There was an investor who bought that at a huge discount. And then he flipped it to us. We bought it for $2.4 million. And within 18 months, we actually upgraded, modified about 50 of the 54 units. Most of the senior residents moved out and we moved in more market rate residents. And with 18 months, we sold that building for $4 million. We walked away with a pure, true $1 million profit after all expenses and after paying all of our investors. And so I think that's a dream deal. We've done that many times, but that's a dream deal for a lot of investors, especially investors looking to either be, you make the pivot from residential into multifamily because it seems manageable, right? To buy a deal for $2 or $2.5 million, it's a lot more manageable than buying a 730 unit. And for limited partners and passive investors, that also seems like a fairly low risk type of deal to invest their money, get a preferred return, and then also get either a bonus or equity in a deal like that. So when I talk to new crowds of new investors, like that's the perfect, in my opinion, the perfect value add multifamily deal that everybody should try to start with or everybody should try to duplicate. I didn't start with that. Actually, the first deal I ever did multifamily was actually the 730 unit. I would not recommend that. I would not recommend that, but for most people, but that was the first one I started with. So it's backwards. And that's the journey I'm on today, right? So that's where I'm at now. But that, it all started back like most people. I was a financial advisor. I was working in a job that I liked, but hours I hated. I worked a lot of nights and a lot of weekends.
How old were you at the time?
Most successful clients owned real estate, right? They owned real estate. They didn't have all their money in the stock market. They didn't have their money with me in mutual funds or IRAs or life insurance. They had their big money in real estate. I took notice over 15 years ago. and ended up quitting that job and getting into real estate. And even though I had made a lot of money as a financial advisor, I had to start, like most people, doing transactional real estate, doing wholesaling and doing things like that to make income to pay my bills. And so that's where I'm at today. And that's a little bit where I started from years and years ago.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. Okay. How long were you a financial advisor for? How old were you when you left that job? And you said you started in wholesaling.
Yeah. I graduated. So I was very lucky, Lauren, to be in a family. I had a very entrepreneurial father. My dad was in the insurance business. He ended up starting an employee benefits company. I got to see entrepreneurship firsthand in my home. My dad built that business from 2 employees to 40 employees. And at one time, his biggest client was Advanced Auto Parts, right? There's an Advanced Auto Parts on every major corner of every major street, 30,000 employees. And my dad did all their employee benefits. So to grow a business from 2 employees to that, I got to witness that in my own house. So when I graduated from college, my dad almost lost his marbles when I told him, Dad, I'm going to go into financial services, because I witnessed it in my own house. He's like, I just paid for this expensive education. You have student loans. What are you doing? And I'm like, Dad, you shouldn't be surprised. Like, I've been watching you for the past 5 or 8 or 10 years. I like what you're doing. Like, I don't want to go do a regular job. I graduated from college. I did an internship with Northwestern Mutual. I was literally a 21-year-old college kid with a life and health license and a Series 6 license. And I started calling on people that were 2, 3, 4, 5 times my age and selling financial services, rollovers, IRAs, life insurance, estate planning. It was probably the best decision, Lauren, I ever made, because at a very young age, I learned how to talk about money. I learned how to talk to older people. I got comfortable around the financial markets and stocks, bonds, mutual funds. And that's really what's led me to raising now over $100 million today for my real estate business. But like anything, like, it was a job, it was very captive. I had to be at the office at a certain time, and I could only put certain things in my marketing that had to be approved by the compliance office. It was very structured. It was very boring to me. So when I saw that my clients owned real estate, I was like, hey, I want to start buying some real estate on the side. So graduated from college in 98, bought my first investment property in 2001. It was a duplex that I actually house hacked. I lived in the first floor with a buddy of mine. I rented out the upstairs. I lived there for $100 a month. And so I bought a $150,000 duplex in the greater Cleveland area. And my mom thought I was nuts. She's, not only are you too young to buy a house, but you're also going to be a landlord. So my dad disapproved, my mom disapproved, everybody hated it except for me. I lived there. I told my mom, Mom, I'm living here for $100 a month.
Yeah.
She's like, wait, what? And so I was in financial services from 1997 until 2004. In 2004, I was about 27, 28 years old. I finally had completely caught the real estate bug and decided to just quit my job cold turkey.
Oh, and so I guess how many deals had you done at that point? Or was it still that duplex and you're like, I see a way out, I'm just going to go for it all in? There's different personality types, right? Yeah. Like, some people will just say, I'm going to wing this. And usually there's no other mortgage, job, kids, wife attached to the husband attached to that, those people. But so did you say, like, I have a plan, I'm just going to go for it? Or did you do both at the same time for a bit?
Yeah.
Did you invest while you were in financial services still?
So interesting. So I have to tell this story from two perspectives, right? It was me and my buddy, Greg. And we were both in the financial services world. We were both in our mid-20s. I was single, no obligations. He was married with 3 kids, okay? But we both were fairly successful financial planning. I was probably making 100 and a quarter, 150 a year. Greg was probably making 300 to 400 a year in financial planning. In the fall of 2004, we really were like half checked in, half checked out of financial services. We were going to weekend warrior boot camps. We were buying courses on marketing, lumpy mail, direct mail messaging, all this kind of stuff. And we decided to get an office together that was off the grid, where we could start our real estate business and kind of hide the fact that we were doing that while we were still financial planners. And back then is when online poker was all the rage. And so we would play poker together. We would play Ultimate Bet and stuff like that. So we were just half in and half out. We had made a lot of money, but we were also very much needed the income. Like, we were not anywhere near financially independent, especially Greg with his wife and new family. And then in June of 2005, I remember it was Greg and I, we both had summer birthdays. We both had June birthdays. We were at a boot camp. It was in Nashville. And we had basically come home from that and said, you know what, dude, screw it. Like, we're just going to flat out quit our jobs cold turkey. Like, we're going to make this work full time. Because we felt like we were half pregnant with both. So we literally got home, quit our jobs. Greg's wife freaked out, but she was very supportive because Greg's a really smart entrepreneur, but she was freaking out. I didn't have family to support, just me. So I guess I tell that story, Lauren, because it really comes down to confidence. It comes down to desire. It comes down to how much do you freaking really believe in yourself? Because I believed in myself, but I had no obligations. Greg, he believed in himself, but he had every obligation, right? Every reason not to quit a high income job and every reason to stick with the financial services, but he decided to quit anyway. So it doesn't really matter. Anybody can quit. Anybody can do it if they really want. And we just felt like we really wanted to get going. We had to put all of our time and all of our effort and all of our energy into it. And the only way to do that was to quit cold turkey. So we both walked away. We walked away from these big incomes. We walked away cold turkey. We poured all of our time and attention into real estate. Now, the result of that, Lauren, was that within the next 12 weeks or so, we flipped and wholesaled 18 properties and made $350,000 in the next 12 weeks after that event. And that was because now we burned the boats, right? We burned the boats. We had to make it work. We had to make the money. We had to freaking figure it out. And we did. And so I'm a big advocate for that. Many people can't stomach that path, but that's what we did.
No, I love that. I do. I think there's definitely that type of person. I myself am more that type of person, but I know people who are, that's not something they're comfortable with, whether or not they have obligations. So it's more, hey, I'm going to do this until my passive income exceeds what I'm making now, or my passive income is at least enough to work with to live until I can grow the real estate. But I love that. I love that you guys literally just, like you said, burn the boats and you had to make it work. I think there's something to be said about that mindset of there's no going back. Like, this is it. This is what I want. And it ignites a certain type of drive, I would say.
Yeah, we would tell ourselves, look, if you want to be successful, give yourself no other option. Give yourself no other option, right? And so if there's no other option of, I can't go back to anything else, I'm not going to have a backup plan. I have no other option. I've got to be successful with this. And I think so many people get into real estate and they go to the Weekend Warrior boot camps or they listen to podcasts or webinars, but they've always got one foot out the door. And then they wonder, like, how come this isn't working for me? Partially, it's because they're not putting all the time and effort into it, 110%. And also psychologically, they're already telling themselves, if I'm not successful, it's okay. I have a backup plan. That's good. You need to burn the boats if you really ultimately want to be successful. I think about Elon Musk, right? When he launched SpaceX, a lot of people have heard this story, but when he landed that one of those first rockets that went up into the atmosphere, came back down and actually landed, like, SpaceX was out of money. If that rocket didn't land and be able to reuse that rocket, they were bankrupt. They had to be successful with it. That's, I think, a mentality that I think can serve a lot of people, not only in real estate, but in entrepreneurship of any kind, is to make sure that you don't have any other option but to be successful and you're going to pour your heart and soul into it.
Yeah, that's a great point. I talked about this on another episode where you essentially have to get to the point where what you're doing, you feel the pain of what you're doing that ignites you to go ahead and burn the boat. So I love that. But okay, so going back, you're late 20s, early 30s at this point. At that point, you were wholesaling. At what point did you move into another asset class, like single family or multifamily? Because I think for our audience listening, you know, that real estate journey is not always linear. Like, you may still do some wholesaling today, or maybe you don't, but a lot of people think, oh, like, he's done multifamily forever. And this is just a good example of you started with wholesaling. And right. Now you're going multifamily. So knowing that path, you don't have to do one thing and that be it. So kind of, how did you transition in, what was that next, like, kind of phase of your real estate career, I guess?
Yes. The next phase was really simple. I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer at that time in 2011. had a 6% survival rate. And so I remember coming home from work. I had two little baby girls at that time. I had a 2-year-old and a 1-year-old. My wife was also 8 months pregnant. And I came home and I walked in the door like any other day. I was roughhousing and wrestling with my kids, having a good time. I rolled over. I'll never forget looking up at the ceiling fan, crossing my hands across my stomach. And I felt this giant lump on the left side of my stomach. And it happened that fast, like that, with just that naturally. I'm like, what is that? And I yelled over to my wife. I said, hey, honey, Lisa, come here, check this out. She starts poking around and it's only on the left side of my stomach below my rib cage. It's hard as a rock. It's not on the right side. So I'm like, this isn't like a hernia. This is really in a weird spot. So long short, I decided to wait till my son was born and then go get checked out. Went and get the CT scan. Sure enough, doctor says, hey, Mr. Cantwell, you know, the words that you never want to hear. I'm sorry to tell you, but you have pancreatic cancer. At that time, if you remember, Steve Jobs from Apple Computer had pancreatic cancer. He had the same exact diagnosis as me. It was the exact same type of pancreatic cancer. And he was on his deathbed dying. And I saw that like right away. And I'm like, this is not good. Yeah. Not only is this bad for my business, but I then had to take 9 months, Lauren, away from work. It was about 3 to 4 months before the surgery to prepare for the surgery and get things in order and all these doctor's appointments, my son being born. And then also another 4 to 5, 6 months after the surgery to recover. The surgeon took out my entire stomach, my entire gallbladder, my spleen, most of my pancreas, most of my liver, had to rebuild the arteries behind my liver. I lost 50 pounds in 3 weeks and I had to relearn how to eat. And guess what happened to my wholesaling business? It evaporated. It disappeared because I couldn't do the business. And I quickly realized that I had a very high paying job. I had replaced my old job of financial services with my new job of wholesaling houses. And I realized I had made a major mistake, which is I did not have any of the passive cash flow that you learn about when you read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and you read multiple streams of income and you fall in love with real estate. You don't fall in love with wholesaling or fall in love with rehab flips. You fall in love with passive income and wealth creation and equity. That's what you fall in love with. Everybody falls into the wholesaling trap because they need to. They have to. That's what happened to me. I also realized at that time that I had this financial services background and I loved raising capital. So I committed now to rebuilding my life around raising money. And I knew that I could learn about the Securities and Exchange Commission and Reg D offerings and private money and private placements. And I was going to just start over. And I had bled hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash during that year or so of recovery. But I ultimately made an amazing decision, which still serves me today, that I was going to do it the right way. I was going to focus on recruiting private money. I was going to do it with other people's money. I started with rehab flips. I then moved into building a rental portfolio. Then I moved into a private equity fund structure, which ultimately led me into multifamily. And all of those, which is really the last 10 years of my life, has all, it doesn't matter what the strategy is, it's all, the backbone of it is raising capital. The backbone of it is getting the private money to do whatever deal I wanted, whether it was rehabs, rentals, the fund, apartments, was I was going to focus on funding first, private money funding, not institutional money, not debt, but true private money. And that's ultimately what set me free today.
Yeah. So tell me about your first conversation when you went, like your first pitch when you went to raise money. Like how did that, your first deal, I guess it would be considered a deal. What was that like?
So honestly, the first time I ever raised money was actually when I first started my real estate career in 2004, 2005. Yeah. I decided we were going to get into wholesaling, but my buddy Greg and I, we didn't have a lot of extra money. And I remember going to the gym. It was a gym down the street.
Always at the gym. Always at the gym.
Dude, raising money at the gym. And my brother's mother-in-law was recently divorced. And she had gotten part of the retirement account from the ex-husband. She was at the gym working out on the elliptical, getting back in shape, getting back in the game, if you will. And we just started talking. I was on one elliptical. She's on the other. Like, she's family, right? Like, she's my brother's mother-in-law. She came to Christmas and Easter. And we were talking a little bit about her divorce. And she said, I inherited this money. It was a couple hundred thousand dollars from this divorce. And I don't know what to do with it. And I was just thinking, oh, what if I borrowed some of this money I'd learned through some boot camps about private money? And sure enough, she decided to do it. So I decided she gave me $65,000 and I promised to pay her 18% interest on a 5-year note. Okay. She did not want the money from it. She just wanted it to grow. So she literally said, I'll give you $65,000 for the next 5 years. And one of the first things I did was we took that money into our operating account. I bought a property for $40,000 that we ended up turning and flipping for $60,000, a very quick wholesale profit. But I had to buy it. It wasn't like an assignment deal. I had to close on it. So we used the money for that. And I used $12,000 to enroll in a coaching program. And so that was the first friends and family offer, right? I didn't know anything about private placements at that time or PPMs. It was just a simple note, an unsecured note. And I realized, hey, if you don't have credibility, which I really didn't, you have to offer something else, which is a very high rate of return. If you have a lot of credibility, then it's the opposite. Now, you don't have to offer a very high rate of return. So there's a give and take there. So that was my very first nickel of private money I ever raised.
Love it. And obviously you've raised tons of capital since then. What would you say were some things that really accelerated that career, that part of your career? Obviously your background in financial services, I'm assuming you're basically selling and building your own book of business, which I would equate to raising capital in a way. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, what are, for people who are looking to raise capital, say they've done some deals or are starting to move towards that fund structure, do you have any recommendations for them or kind of learnings?
One of the things I learned from financial services, which is also Gary Keller teaches a similar strategy in his book. I can't remember what his famous book is called off the top of my head, but he talks about it. So in the financial services world, we called it our Project 100. So we would write down 100 names, phone numbers, email addresses, physical addresses of people that we already knew, friends, your family, your doctor, your whatever, your barber, your everything, right? Just people that you know. And we would, in the financial services world, they would teach you to go out to those people and not sell them anything, but present to them what you do. And then in a way, you're just saying, this is what I do. If they're interested, they'll say, hey, what about me? Need that. And if not, hopefully they would refer you. So I used that exact technique when it came to private money. I made a list of about 100 people. It might've been 50. It might've been 200. I don't remember exactly. But I created this Project 100 of people that I thought, hey, who can sell me a property? Who can I buy a property from? Who can be a private lender? Or who could be a cheerleader in my real estate business? And Greg and I did this way back, and then I did it again and again over the years. So this is a really archaic manual way of raising capital. We don't do it this way anymore. But when I got started, and what advice I would give people is do exactly this. Create your Project 100, first name, last name, email, phone, physical address, put them into a database, create a marketing postcard or a newsletter, send it out to all of them, then follow up with a phone call and say, hey, did you get my newsletter? What did you think about it? Or did you get my postcard? What did you think about it? And then what we would do in the financial services world is I would say, hey, listen, I would love to get together with you over a beer, a cup of soup, a donut, whatever, and just tell you a little bit more about what I'm doing. I'm not assuming that you're interested in investing at all. I'm not assuming that you have any money to invest, but you're one of my close friends or family. I just want to share with you what it is that I'm doing in case you run across someone who may be interested in you, you could refer me. I'll be a top of mind reference for you. You could refer me. So then I would go meet with them and I would present how private lending worked. A note, a mortgage, whether it was a preferred return with equity, which is what we do now with apartments. And then at the end, I would just say, hey, do you know anybody? And what I was doing back then, Lauren, is I was presenting primarily for rehab flips. I would present and show a 12% interest or 15% of my profits, whichever was greater. And so people started to say at the end of the conversation, I would say, hey, do you know anybody that would be interested more about learning about this? And then they all started saying, hey, Josh, what about me? Like, I'm interested in getting 12%. I'm interested if that's my floor, 12%, and I could get more than that if the 15% of the profit is better than 12%, I can get more. I'm interested in that. And they liked it even more because I wasn't pitching them. I never asked them for money. I never presented them in a way. I didn't have no idea. I didn't want to pitch my mom or my uncle or my friends for money. I wanted to present to them in a way that was super cool, super low, no pressure.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they all started saying, Josh, I would do that for you. I would be happy to do that. And so that approach works and it still works today. And I would say anybody who, you know, is getting started in their real estate journey, that is maybe getting into wholesaling or pivoting from wholesaling to larger deals or pivoting into multifamily, is to start with a similar approach to that. Today, Lawrence, totally different for us. We have a huge digital marketing presence. We have this huge podcast. We've got tens of thousands of subscribers. And every time I pitch a deal, it sells out in an hour. Like, we can raise $5 or $10 million in less than a day. But that's how I started years ago.
Yeah. And I think it, people invest with not only the asset class, but people that they trust, they know and trust. There's that big know, like, trust factor that goes into everything. So I would imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're speaking with these 100 people that you have some sort of know, like, trust with. So yes, they're going to be more prone to be like, oh yes, I will invest with you. But then that grows. You gain a track record by being able to repay these people. You gain credibility with people that they refer you to. So it's that room, like that snowball effect, essentially.
No
like
doubt.
Starting and then gaining that kind of credibility in the space, but also referrals, more trust. And then, like you said, now it's shifted to where you have that brand presence and you can put a deal out there and it sells out almost immediately.
No doubt. And along those same lines, Lauren, what we did right as we started to really scale the business is I believe every great business is a partnership. I believe that most, like, everyone talks about Warren Buffett, but his partner's Charlie Munger. They're 1A and 1B.
Yeah.
Every one of Elon Musk's businesses, he has a president or a chief executive that runs SpaceX, Twitter, Tesla. It's not just him. So every business I feel like I've been successful with, and I've had three main partnerships in my real estate journey, it's all been a partnership. And one of us was responsible for one swim lane and somebody else was responsible for a different swim lane. I found out very quickly that I was good at the front of the business, marketing, sales, acquisitions, and raising money. And I needed to bring somebody in who was more of the operational person to execute the deals, more of the contracts, the logistics, the paperwork, that kind of thing. So I believe that every business has a front end guy that or girl that brings in business in the house. And I have the belief that there's another partner that takes care of the deals once they're in the house and or getting them out of the house to make a profit. And I believe that is a major formula for success. So I was able to split the responsibility where I was focused on acquisitions. I was focused on finding deals. I was focused on finding capital. That's all I had to do. And I got really good at it. And I was able to scale that very quickly.
Yeah. So basically finding someone that is your good opposite just to divide that work and have that focus. I think that's something I've seen across all the partnerships that have been super successful is there's that yin and yang and it works really well.
And it's got to. And that's one of the keys of partnerships is that you have to be comfortable finding someone and working with someone who's almost your polar opposite. You need to find somebody like the opposites attract in a relationship, in a romantic relationship. Opposites attract, they should attract in a business relationship. Because trust me, if me had to do the front end and me also had to manage the back of the house, the business would fall apart. Me couldn't do both. I have only one personality and skill set. And I love to be the front end of the business, marketing, sales, podcasts, webinars, talking to investors, talking to brokers, creating relationships, being out at events, being in front of people in my community. And that's allowed me the time and the bandwidth to get really good at raising money and the psychological warfare, if you will, of raising money, because I got to know how people think, what their risk tolerance is. And I got really good at that. Versus, hey, if I had to be good at all that and had to be good at leasing, evictions, had to be good at refinances, I couldn't do both. Like, I would fail.
Yeah.
partnerships are cool. Now, in my business now, there's three of us. My swim lane is what I just described, and I'm the CEO, majority owner. Glenn is my partner who manages all of our capital improvements, CapEx. And we have right now about a $7 million CapEx budget. So major budget. We have a huge team that's all under the construction. And then Tyler is our partner who focuses on asset management. So he oversees all of our property managers. And we have four major property managers that work under us. We work with RHM, REM, Trinity Multifamily, and Asset Living. There's four major multifamily property managers. And so they sit under Tyler. And because of that partnership, we're all able to be really good at what we do. Now, in order for Lauren, for that to happen, you have to have a big enough portfolio that you can divide that up and there still be enough meat on the bone that everybody can make a living and achieve their goals. So we realized if the three of us were going to be in business, we had to get really big, really fast in order to support all of our families, right? And we were able to do that. So that's a big part of it. For me, raising money, if I had to do everything else also, I wouldn't nearly be as good at it.
I love that. To bring it all together, if my key takeaways kind of from our conversation would be go big or go home, burn the boat, burn the boat. So shift that mentality. If you're looking to get into real estate, shifting that mentality to make it basically a non-negotiable. This has to succeed. There is no fallback plan. And I would say that's where I do see a lot of people kind of fail is by thinking or having that fallback plan and not going all in. Starting with your 100 list when you're looking to raise capital or get your first deal funded by someone else's money. And then the third thing, which is hasn't come up yet, I'm actually surprised, but it's such a great point, is the team. You think, oh, I love this person. We're really similar. We have the same energy, but you don't need two people to do that job. You need one person here and one person over here. So I love that. Finding the opposites attract all-star team to be able to grow and scale quickly. So no, anything else that any other, if someone came to you today and said, hey, I am ready to leave my job, my high paying job, I want to get started, what would your like number one tip be to them?
Yeah, I think there's a big misconception out there that if you find the right deal, the money will follow. I do not subscribe to that. I subscribe to, look, when my real estate business took off and all of a sudden I wasn't a six-figure investor. I wasn't an eight-figure investor. I was a nine-figure investor. It was because of the funding. The funding comes first, especially when you're doing large multifamily deals or even medium-sized or small-sized multifamily deals. The seller has to be convinced that they have a certainty of closing. When they award you the deal and say they're going to sell it to you, whether it's direct to seller, whether it's through a wholesaler, or whether it's through a broker, they have to have a certainty of closing. That certainty of closing comes from, sure, credibility or experience, but not really. What it comes from is, do they have the certainty of knowing that you're going to be able to raise that 20 to 35% of the deal that the bank is not going to fund? In every one of my large multifamily deals, the banks fund out of the total capital stack, there's about 30 to 35% of the deal that I need to raise myself. So if I'm buying a $10 million deal and I need $13 million all in to cover everything, including CapEx, soft costs, and everything like that, I'm going to have to raise about $3.6 million. Okay. That certainty of closing, I can go get the bank loan. It's easy. I can go get a partnership. That's easy. I go find the deal. That's easy. The toughest part is that last 20 to 30, 35% of the capital stack that's going to come from true private investors. So I tell, look, funding equals freedom, not debt funding, not institutional funding of any kind, but the true private capital where you're raising that from other investors, other mom and pop private investors. If you can do that, you can write your freaking ticket to retire early, to financial independence. Nobody ever fails in this business, Lauren, when they have too much private money. They fail when they've got too many deals and not enough private money. Or if they have a deal going sideways, like I've had deals that go sideways, a lot of people that would bankrupt them. For me, I was able to recruit more money to cure the problem, right? So private money, true private money, funding equals freedom. I would have never been able to retire early in my 40s if I didn't truly focus on getting that private capital, okay? Creative financing is great. Creative deals are great. But the guys that I know that have true wealth, whether it's in single family, multifamily, commercial, resi, notes, mortgages, whatever, they've been really skilled at raising money from other people.
I love that. And that is funny because we do a ton of episodes from people in real estate. And I would agree with you, but I'm on your side of the house. So naturally that makes sense. But that's not something we hear a lot. And I think, you know, again, bias here, but I agree. I think the money, like you said, you can't, the funds that struggle, it's because they don't have the money to buy the deals. So
that and is- not only that, but the best brokers, the biggest wholesalers, the biggest owners, the biggest brokers that control the really substantial deal flow, they're going to award deal after deal to the group that can close, that has the private money. So if you put the funding first, then the deals will follow. Versus if you put the deals first, the money does not always follow. But if you have so much capital that you know you can close and you can give people a certainty of closing, you're gonna, I've got brokers throwing deals at me like, Josh, do you want this one? Do you want this one? Here's a pocket listing. It's a $10 million apartment. Here's a pocket listing. It's a $20 million. Here's a pocket listing for a senior assisted living facility, a storage facility. They're throwing them at us. We get to cherry pick because we built that reputation of having the money to close. Versus if it was the opposite, maybe I'd be able to buy one deal, then I'd struggle to get the money. Then the next deal struggled to get the money. So that's my major piece of advice.
I love it. I love it. Thank you so much for joining us today on the CWS podcast. For those listening, if you're interested in connecting with Josh, you know, I know you also do real estate coaching as well. How can someone connect with you, learn more about you, your funds, or your coaching?
Yep. So we only now, we don't do any, like we don't have any programs or anything like that. We just do one very high level mastermind group for experienced operators. But you can check all that out at our main website, which is freelandventures.com. You can check out there our YouTube channel and our Facebook group and the mastermind. You can see our portfolio if you want to become a private investor with us, blah, 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 all on freelandventures.com.
And you also have your podcast as well. Do you want to give that a plug here?
Sure, yeah. Freeland Ventures, again, you can find it there, but it's called Accelerated Investor. It's primarily for those people who are in commercial multifamily and apartments or people who are aspiring to scale up into commercial multifamily. That's what the podcast is all about.
Love it. So if you're interested in that or you want to connect to Josh, go check out freelandventures.com. I'll also add that in the show notes for you guys. So again, thank you, Josh, so much for joining us on this episode. If you guys listening enjoyed the show, share it with a friend, subscribe, or leave us a review. Until next time, bye.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.